What are the tools, the approaches that companies can use to actually recognize those reductions in a credible way?
We would go for a before and after PCF or product carbon footprint. When we do PCFs as a snapshot in time associated usually with a particular facility and a particular stock keeping unit or product, which means that we can get very, very specific with our PCFs. We could have 100 PCFs if we needed to around a specific product over a period of time. So you can actually like monitor all the changes that happens. And you could do that at a super, super low cost. And so the way that we would think about doing this is saying, let's say it was packaging. You bought this bottle in January 2024, a number of changes have happened to transition to, let's say, renewable electricity instead of gas, and it's a hybrid furnace. And now in January 2026, we want to do another PCF of the same glass bottle because we believe that those changes have reduced the emissions. In that case, we would have these two PCFs, the before and after PCF, and the delta is the change that's happened. And that allows us to have measurable and attributable change, which means that we've measured the change and we can attribute it to this specific supplier, this specific material, and in fact, also this specific intervention that made the delta.
I'm Isabel Wild. Welcome to the State of Sustainability podcast, a show for professionals transforming corporate sustainability strategies, brought to you by Altruistic. In today's episode, we're outlining our approach to credibly deploy and recognize Scope 3 emissions reductions. So what's the challenge? The traditional standard setters have provided quite high-level, limited frameworks to account for carbon reductions. And more recently, the mass balance-based measurement approach has been used. We've done a previous episode on this, so we'll add that in the show notes. But that basically ensures that reductions in the value chains are not double-counted. But I think everybody who's been through that process can actually agree that it's quite a big burden of making the claim. So today, we're going to dig into the workarounds. But first, Seth, should we dig into that, the challenges a bit more detail?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, Izzy, right now, companies typically have two parallel sets of books that they're maintaining effectively. There is their corporate footprinting and carbon accounting, where they have scope 1, 2, and 3, and so on. And then they usually have some project-based plans and project-based inventories that they're working towards as well, where they're saying, hey, I'm going to be doing something with relation to soy or packaging or whatever, and I'm going to have a project-based inventory for that. And they're trying to reconcile the two retrospectively or at the end of the line. And increasingly, as we move towards activity-based and volume-based scope 3 measurement, companies are starting to think through how they can actually run initiatives and projects that will directly impact the emissions factor that they're using for scope 3 and actually directly reduce the scope 3 numbers. In short, what they're looking for is some ability to identify change that is measurable and attributable. That means that the change can actually be measured. They know what it was, and it can be attributed to a specific thing that they did, a specific supplier that they worked with, a specific material that was changed.
Awesome. And begun thinking about this and approaching this in 5 key steps. So the 5 steps are step 1, data setup, step 2, intervention identification, step 3, implementation, step 4, measurement and tracking, and step 5, validation and verification. And for the purpose of this podcast, we're going to run through each step. So step 1, Seth, what are the specific data requirements that companies must address up front to ensure that they can later track, measure, and verify emission reductions? Where do we need to start?
Purchases data. That's the simplest way to think about it. We are typically looking for all the things you've bought, who you bought it from, where you bought it, when you bought it. And so the way that we work on this at Altruistic is we try and get the raw data with as much granularity and as much metadata as is available. By that, I mean, I know there'll be many solutions that might require you to aggregate data. So maybe you have like 1 million unique transactions, let's say, over the last year. And actually, you typically would be aggregating that up to 10,000 categories, whereas actually we'd like the 1 million, every unique kind of line item almost, we'd like to have that. By metadata, I mean that as much classification data as is available. Sometimes this will be structured with the purchasing data. So you might have, for instance, information on currencies. You might have some categories already embedded in the purchasing data, but often this is very subjective qualitative information that individuals in your business will have. So they might know how much recycled content was used in a particular type of packaging material, but this isn't necessarily written down in any kind of tabular format. And so we'd look to capture that as well. So we usually want as much, as rich an information set from the purchasing side as possible, because we're going to use that data to identify two things, both of which will overlap. One is which suppliers are most material from an emissions contribution perspective. And the second is which materials or sale items within those suppliers are the most material to focus on. So you might say, actually, like, I have 20,000 suppliers and 100 of them are really important. And from those 100, you might be buying 1,000 different things, but actually maybe 500 or 300 things that you're buying from those 100 suppliers are actually the ones that you need to care about. So we are usually guided from a materiality standpoint by the purchases data.
Is there a minimum threshold? Because I know that quite a lot of guidance that's out there, if you are reporting on your emission reduction to happen, is still in draft. There isn't any concrete kind of evidence there to say what you need, what you don't need. In terms of like the accuracy of your data that you need, so whether it be primary or secondary, or whether you're using supply specific or spend based data, are there any thresholds that you should be aware of or anything to keep in mind when you're thinking about the quality and the granularity of the data that you're collecting?
Yeah, I would say that if you are on the journey towards a flag conformant data set and target, then you're probably capturing much of what we would look for anyway. And so you're already capturing or starting to capture weights, locations, getting a sense of the activities that went into producing the thing that you're buying. All of this data would be typically necessary for you to set a sort of flag conformant scope 3 that you can use for a flag target. Bearing in mind, obviously, the guidance is still in flux, but we know what the SBTI targets look like. We have a reasonable sense, I would say, of direction of travel on the greenhouse gas protocol side as well. And so typically locations, weights, activities will be par for the course on this.
Awesome. So on step 2, which is intervention identification. So what am I targeting? Who am I supposed to be working with? And what am I trying to change?
So these are all the questions you must answer, Izzy, as you go on this journey. And so depending on which materials you identify, which materials and suppliers you identify as most important, it will be helpful to do some clustering to make implementation easy. What I mean by that is that really there might be 20 different categories of intervention that could be relevant across the, let's say, 30 suppliers that you've chosen to work with on this stuff. However, you want to try and narrow that down to make it easier to implement. So you might say, well, I'm going to actually take 2 intervention types and apply them broadly across all these suppliers that I'm going to be working with. So maybe you say heat pumps and electrified mobility are easy for me to implement and chalk up some wins on the board, whereas actually regenerative agriculture, while it might be kind of sexy and interesting, actually is probably not the best one for most companies because it's hard, it takes a long time to show impact. It looks very different depending on the material, the actual crop type that you're working with and the location. I know obviously a lot of companies are setting up great regen ag programs, but you might find quicker wins are going to be had in a lot of the fuel transition, energy transition, packaging transition type of space, for example. So I would say that identifying what are the 1 or 2 interventions that are top of my list to implement from an ease, cost, timeline perspective is the next thing to think about. On our side, we're starting to build out these decarbonization roadmaps for the key suppliers of our large customers. And usually we're taking this view, what is the share of emissions that this will impact? What is the cost that it will have per ton? What is the expected timeline to have an impact? And we're going to prioritize based on that.
Awesome. And is that kind of through like a MAC curve, a cost benefit analysis? What are we doing there?
A MAC curve is like a very specific thing that I have found to be personally quite useless in a business environment, but I find a MAC curve a good source of inspiration. So a MAC curve, for those who don't know, is a marginal abatement cost curve popularized by McKinsey and other consulting firms in the early 2000s, like 2007, 8, 9, 10 was when the MAC curves originated, and they tended to take an industry-wide view at a snapshot in time. And so let me maybe briefly just describe how that worked and then the bits that we take and the bits that we don't. The way a MAC curve works is you take the whole emissions, you identify a lever or an initiative for each category of emissions, and you put them on a cost curve, moving from the least expensive to the most expensive. And so the initiatives that are, let's say, closest to the zero on the curve, closest to the axis on the curve, will often be stuff that's in the money. Making this transition actually makes you money, doesn't cost you money. And the stuff at the far end of the curve will be the stuff that looks expensive. This is useful because it gives you an overall view, like a picture on the full emissions and what the full emissions decarbonization would cost. It is less useful, I was going to say useless, but less useful for a few reasons. One is that it is a snapshot in time, and actually what you need is something more dynamic. Secondly, you are actually going to implement things at different points in time. You're not going to implement the most expensive stuff today. You're probably going to wait 5 years and see if it gets cheaper. And then also actually different parts of your business might have different MAC curves. You might need 20, 30 different MAC curves, really. So what we see as more useful really is just a table, frankly, and we've kind of built this into our platform as well. And so the table will have, each initiative might have a different start date, it might have a different end date, it might have a ramp where you actually say the initiative is going to go from 10% in year one to 30% in year two to 70% in year three and so on, which could be very flexible. It's going to have a cost assumption, CapEx or OpEx, that might be different year on year as the cost evolves. And so we're able to get a lot more color into that. But it, in principle, it draws inspiration from the same logic.
Awesome. Thank you for explaining that. I think maybe that should we go on to the step three, which is implementation, which I think we've covered quite a few elements of it. But are there any other like hurdles that companies face when setting up projects that will be accepted as credible reductions further down the line?
Yeah, so implementation requires expertise. And I would say that there are probably at least two critical partners for that, and maybe a third. The two are the company that is producing the thing that you're buying. So let's say if it's something in dairy, it might be like a Land O'Lakes, something in packaging, it might be an Amcor. Whoever it is, like this is your actual partner. This is your supply chain partner that you're going to be working with. The second might be a project implementation partner. And there are situations where the supplier could also be the project implementation partner. Like this is something that they are well able to do themselves operationally. They are going to fully deliver it end to end. But very often there will be a third party that actually needs to come on board. So let's take a couple of examples. Heat pump installation, solar panel installation, you know, a lot of elements of CapEx, there might need to be a third party that actually comes in and sets this up, brings the equipment, installs it, all that sort of stuff. And this might be something that your supplier will identify themselves and they'll say, hey, we're totally capable to go out and run a tender and find our own source of this sort of equipment and expertise. Or you as, let's say, the brand, for want of a better word, the requester of change, you may say, hey, actually, we're seeing this thematically across many suppliers. Let us run a centralized purchasing process to bring on these solution partners who can then work with selected suppliers of ours. So those are, I would say, the two more or less integral collaboration partners, the supplier and the implementation partner. There might be a third, which is someone to manage the change aspect. We'll talk about this a little in the tracking context. But you want to have the delta or the shift validated somehow by another third party, such that it is not the supplier marking their own homework or the implementation partner marking their own homework and just saying, yes, we did this thing, we got paid to do this thing, and surprise, surprise, this thing that we did was useful and had an impact. You might want to have a third party doing that, whether it's a third party doing a PCF like we would do or an LCA or something similar, that's subjective.
Okay, so actually onto that, so step four, measurement and tracking. What are the tools, the approaches that companies can use to actually recognize those reductions in a credible way and actually account for them as well?
So typically we would go for a before and after PCF or product carbon footprint. And when we do PCFs as a snapshot in time associated usually with a particular facility and a particular stock keeping unit or product, which means that we can get very, very specific with our PCFs. We could have 100 PCFs if we needed to around a specific product over a period of time. So you can actually like monitor all the changes that happens. And you could do that at a super, super low cost. Like, you know, we're talking in dollars basically rather than hundreds of dollars for an individual PCF at a certain scale, which is a radical cost reduction versus LCAs, which opens up a huge set of new use cases for this functionality, which is quite cool. And so the way that we would think about doing this is saying, you bought this thing in January 2024, let's say it was packaging, you bought this bottle in January 2024, a number of changes have happened to transition to, let's say, renewable electricity instead of gas, and it's a hybrid furnace. And now in January 2026, we want to do another PCF of the same glass bottle because we believe that those changes have reduced the emissions. In that case, we would have these two PCFs, the before and after PCF, and the delta is the change that's happened. And that allows us to have measurable and attributable change, which means that we've measured the change and we can attribute it to this specific supplier, this specific material, and in fact, also this specific intervention that made the delta. I would say that's probably the side that can scale really well, often for like a tier one supplier. If you're going all the way back to agriculture, you might also want to involve an MRV solution to incorporate satellite imagery, for instance, and see what the change maybe is on forest cover or land management practice. That often has high cost associated and some restrictions based on geography, crop type, etc. And then there are those who can kind of only really do above ground, and anything beyond that gets really fuzzy, versus you might have to have someone come in and do soil testing. So that space can get quite complicated as you start to get into the field, so to speak.
And are you seeing a skew in the market of kind of reduction initiatives towards more energy-based ones, which perhaps are easier to track and verify, versus agricultural ones, which are, as you said, have maybe a high price tag associated with it, as well as like a higher resource requirement?
A good portfolio will have all of them. They will have some interventions that are quick yielding, stuff that will show up in the numbers within, let's say, 1 year to 2 years, for example. A lot of the energy transition stuff will show up in that time frame. A lot of packaging stuff can show up in that time frame, logistics, etc. And so you want to have a lot of these, I wouldn't even call them low-hanging fruit, because I don't think they're always low-hanging as such, but they are quicker impact. But then you also want to make sure that you have some line of sight to large contributors that will take time to decarbonize. And so if you're like a PepsiCo, for instance, and you're buying lots of potatoes for the crisps, if you're a Coca-Cola, you know, not to be heathen and mention both in the same episode, but if you're like a Coca-Cola and you buy lots of sugar, and you know sugar is going to be really hard to drive an impact on, then those are things that it makes sense for you to start the ball rolling, because it's going to be a decade-long journey. I think that the companies that are newer to the field are prioritizing maybe the quicker wins, the energy transition stuff, because it's easier to get going and it's the stuff that is most likely to be a mandatory requirement as you start looking at scope 1 and 2 targets, for example. But I think a good portfolio has a balance.
Yeah. In your opinion, what are the hardest ones in the field at the moment? What are the ones that people are kind of running from the hills for, or perhaps actually waiting until their competitors or their friends are up to speed where they can collaborate on the big beasts together?
There's no shortage of hard ones. And I think that hard ones should be classified by technical maturity, implementation maturity, and cost maturity. Like, I would probably take these three. And let me say a little more about what I mean by this. If we take alternative fuels for logistics, a lot of this stuff is not technically mature. E-fuels or synthetic fuels or hydrogen as a fuel, whatever people might say who are in that side of the space, these are not fully technically mature solutions. They have not been tested at scale globally. We don't fully know how they're going to work if they're in play all the time at scale. So I would say that there's a technical maturity question there. However, for many of them, implementation maturity may not be super hard, for example. Like, if you're basically just replacing one piece of kit with another piece of kit, but the workflow for the individual is the same. I'm going to be driving a truck, and it's going to be a hydrogen-powered truck, or it's going to be a diesel-powered truck, I'm still driving a truck, you could argue that the implementation maturity is not super high. And then there's the cost aspect, which is this something that's going to become a lot cheaper over time or stay expensive, or is it something that is already actually cost mature, which means that whatever gains we were expecting on cost have been realized. So Hydrogen, again, a good example. There's been expectation for a while that electrolyzer costs are going to shoot down, and therefore actually hydrogen will become a lot cheaper. So there's the cost maturity aspect as well. I think that the problem that I see coming up most often, I see like actually two variations of problem coming up in this sort of space. One is when it comes to packaging, recycled content and recyclability both rely on system-wide changes that are really difficult to get going. And if those system-wide changes don't get solved, then you amp up the technical complexity because you have to kind of engineer around them, or you amp up the implementation complexity because the company has to go much further out of its comfort zone and solve for like end-of-life usage, etc. Or you amp up the cost complexity because the company has to, again, try and find expensive ways to solve around this. And so that's one that I see coming up a lot. Another that I see coming up is the availability of alternative materials at scale. So think of like alternative proteins and this sort of stuff, where because a lot of this is still in R&D mode or innovation mode or pilot mode, getting it at the volume you need can often be just very challenging. And that, of course, impacts cost as well. But really, like Izzy, this is like a massive bag of chips that you could dip your hand in and come out with a different fistful of initiatives each time.
Yeah, I'm keen to actually get your take on the Bova controversy that's happened at the moment. And for listeners who haven't tuned into this, it's Arla announced that they had rolled out Bova, which is a methane mitigation supplement, which I spoke about in previous episodes, that cuts methane from, well, enteric methane from cows. And there has been a big consumer backlash around this because it's seen as, you know, another additive into our milks. There have been other milk companies that are actually rolling back to say, we aren't using this, when actually it is one of, you know, a big way that companies are trying to cut methane emissions from their baseline at quite a high cost. Seth, what's your take on this? Because this is a supposedly, you know, quite a cool sustainability initiative that's happening to reduce the impact of milk, but people have turned around and be like, whoa, no, I don't want this. Like, I've seen videos of consumers pouring Arla milk down the sink, which is crazy. What are your thoughts?
I always find it really funny when people buy something only to destroy it, which of course is like a massive demand signal to the company. But that said, like, and I don't know if I'm being controversial here or not, but I think most people are just ignoring the cow in the room, which is we've turned all these domestic animals into little factories. And for frankly, centuries, if not millennia, we have been feeding them things to maximize their output of meat and milk. We have been breeding them selectively together. And let's not even get into how we do this breeding stuff, right? Like I once had to set up an artificial livestock insemination facility in a previous life, which was really like a somewhat traumatic experience for me. We've been doing this for longer than anyone or their great grandparents can remember. This is a very small thing in contrast. Like it's not like most of these consumers knew what the animal was being fed at scale across the industry anyway. Right? Like if you kind of go and have a look at what livestock in most countries is fed, in most places it's fed on waste, like domestic waste, waste from, you know, the restaurant kitchens and all this stuff. Like I've seen this firsthand in the Philippines. And when I was doing this Asian waste analysis, it was just interesting to see how the whole waste system ends up being quite circular because animals are used as the final consumption of a lot of food waste. So I think this is a small thing, frankly, that is probably not amongst the worst things that are happening to animals by any measure, and probably in the scale of things, inconsequential in terms of how the animal feels about it. That said, I may, of course, retract all of this if there's like a massive lawsuit and Dark Waters-style movie on this in a few years.
Well, it's crazy. I think I heard that actually a cow is fed almost like a wheelbarrow of food a day, and the Bova makes up just a teaspoon of what that is.
It's kind of what I mean, right? Like it's, yeah.
And equally, M&S did an announcement about using Bova a few months ago, and they got, I think it was about 13 comments or something on a Daily Mail article that was published because of it. And Arla has just had an onslaught of kind of comments because of it. So I think it comes around, the point I'm trying to like maybe get to is around communicating your implementation or your carbon reduction, because actually it's not always seen as perhaps a good thing to the consumer, despite thinking it will be because, you know, everyone's focused on sustainability. There are other considerations at play, like, you know, nutrition, health, quality, yada, yada, yada.
I agree. I think there are these two things that somehow, two myths that somehow a lot of people have fixated on. One is that sustainability pays for itself. And the other is that sustainability is always not just good for the planet, but good for creation or creatures as well. And like these two things are just not always true. You know, like if you kind of think about what's best for the planet, it's probably like a massive livestock genocide right now, actually. And everyone switches to plant-based food, but actually all the livestock just gets slaughtered en masse. Maybe that's like net a good thing from an overall cruelty impact perspective. I don't know. But, you know, or it's like just keeping, you know, really radically reducing the amount of space that an animal inhabits, because actually the more space that you have for it, the more land use is being taken up. So I think there's a lot of these things that are just in contradiction with each other. And on the cost side, you might get the first 5% or 10% of reductions cost neutral. But after that, it's called an externality for a reason. And that's because it's not priced in.
Yeah. On step five, before we go down another rabbit hole of controversial implement reduction initiatives, but step five is validation and verification. So do companies need third-party verifiers for this final step? And like, what evidence do you need to support it? Is this the PCF delta or otherwise?
So in general, we're seeing third-party verification increase radically, almost, I was going to say year on year, but maybe like even quarter on quarter, where most companies that are disclosing their greenhouse gas inventory or carbon footprint are using one party to calculate it and another party to verify it. And that is just becoming best practice. And I think that the direction of travel for reductions is going to be the same, which is if a reduction has happened, the reduction should be verified by a third party as well to make sure that you're not marking your own homework. I think that the other piece, the question mark is going to be, is there a general ledger of some sort such that two parties can't take credit for the same reduction and you don't get double counting? That piece, I think, as an industry, we have a lot less clarity on. There are some ledger concepts that are being mooted or piloted. Like there's the Value Change Initiative has a ledger that it's building for reductions from its member companies. There's obviously going to be a question around whether maybe some of the existing ledgers for carbon offsets could be maybe repurposed or grow in time. I think this is just a, you know, space for more innovation.
And what's the cost going to be of these third-party verifiers? Is it going to be significant? Is it something that needs to be built into the overall cost pipeline of one of these initiatives?
Well, you know, I was kind of just doing the math to myself one day, as one does. And I found that, like, if you look at the EU CSRD, before that came out, the European Commission had an impact assessment done where they tried to form an opinion on how much it would cost a company to comply with CSRD requirements. And I'll bring this back, Izzy, to your point in a moment. But their assessment was that it would cost roughly a few million dollars for an average company to comply with CSRD requirements. And the scope of companies they had was around, I think, 48,000 companies, which means we're well beyond like Fortune 500 sort of companies and actually well into mid-market, you know, mid-sized business territory. I would say probably businesses doing a few hundred million dollars of revenue would be captured. If you look at the amount that those companies are spending today on CSRD reporting, I am certain it is a fraction of the few million dollars that the impact assessment suggests. And so I think that regulation and quasi-regulation countenances or anticipates a much higher spend than most companies have done historically. And I think verification will not be the biggest part of that. I think it'll be one of the smaller ends of that expense.
Awesome. Seth, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I think that what we're discussing now is going to be the basis of a playbook. And whether Altruistic and its customers write the playbook or adopt the playbook or contribute to the playbook, but there is going to be a playbook for how companies do this well in terms of achieving measurable and attributable change, where they can say, this was my number. This is how the number changed. This is why it changed. This is what it changed to. And these are the people that have signed off on it. I think that playbook is being written live. And that's actually quite exciting because I think we can repurpose that from emission. We can take it from emissions to emissions at scale, but then we can also repurpose it to water and frankly, a whole host of environmental impacts.
Okay, so in absence of any formalized guidance or standardization around this, your advice would be to get going, to start gathering purchase data ready for your PCFs?
Yeah, I mean, let's kind of not forget that the guidance originated with industry. It's not like the Greenhouse Gas Protocol and SBTI just sort of spontaneously existed and were original thought by a Plato in a cave somewhere. These things were informed by business and by, many interviews at the time, many consultation groups. And what industry was doing played a big role in what standard setters thought should be done. And I think at some point over the last few years, we sort of forgot that and thought actually standard setters should tell us what we should do. But actually industry best practice in this space, I think, was the guide and will be the guide again. The standards are really for the bottom 50%, not the top 50%. The top 50%, and that's a much bigger pool than just saying the top 1% of companies. Like the top half of companies will be the ones that contribute to defining the guidance. And then the bottom 50% are the ones that will be more or less forced or expected to comply.
Awesome. Seth, thank you so much. That's all for today. And we'll add all the podcast references that we did to the show notes. Thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks all.
Bye.